first thing that's that's mentioned quite often is the pandemic, you know, and what governments have done over the past 18 months, governments around the world have done over the past 18 months in response to the pandemic, which was to shut down large sections of society, and as a result, reduce demand for many products, and you know, it essentially interfered with the global supply chain of many different products, including energy.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section, which means it's time to take a deep look at the energy crisis, the big energy crunch. Well, in order to get an idea about the energy crisis, we need to take a look at what types of energy commodities there are in the first place. Well, there you have it. This is a good way of looking at it. We try to cover all of them. You got things like wind and solar, coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, bioenergy, pumped storage, gas and interconnectors, and of course, since we didn't have much room, we put it under other fuels. Well, let's take all of these energy commodities and then get a sense of how much each of them are being used across the world. And this graph is going to give you an idea, because what we did was we took it and we looked at the average median, if you will, to get an idea of its usage overall. So as you can see over here, as this is being formed, the one in orange is gas, which is the most widely used form of usage. You got nuclear and then coal, which come in second and third place, respectively. In terms of coal, that's the one in the black that you see in the bottom here. Now, let's take a look in particular at wind and solar, because there's so much talk about fighting climate change. And of course, that's green energy. You could see that the usage really peaks right around this area over here. Now, that's quite a lot for wind and solar, if you think about it. Although its usage is at the bottom, renewable now provide actually a third of power generation. However, that's still not enough to provide all the energy needs at this time when the global economy is bouncing back from the COVID-19 pandemic. The shortage that is being experienced now is set to be a short-term squeeze, if you want to call it maybe a jolt. After colder than normal winter depleted natural gas inventories, gas and electricity prices soared, as you can see over here. This is actually outlining it. However, this actually is showing what has resulted as a result of gas and energy usage overall, which basically you're looking at inflation. Inflation is soaring across what we use as a barometer for the G7 economies. So you can see the effect that it has there. And that brings us to China. Now, China, believe it or not, has had an energy shortage as a result of all of this, and this graph shows it incrementally is going to go, as you can see, pointing to that. The industrial economy still relies heavily on fossil fuels, and of course that naturally means coal, gas, and oil. The country simply does not have enough fuel. Why? Because it was trying to transition to cleaner energy to help with the climate crisis. Here is China's power usage, as you can see, showing what I just talked about. Which basically means it needs coal as an example. Now, Chinese manufacturing is something that has happened that is very unusual because of the transition that it was trying to make. It actually contracted in September for the first time. That occurred for the first time in 19 months. And guess what happens when China needs gas, oil, and coal? Well, it's going to hoard up all the energy as much as it can, which, as a result, will affect the rest of the world, like it has done in Europe, because there are tighter energy supplies as a result. And in particular, it has affected the UK. So you can see the effect that China has on the world when it's trying to keep up with the demand that is coming through so that it could have its production ramped up. This is our new section where we will look at social media posts, web entries, viewer comments, and the like, and discuss this with our guests. We hope to have your input so we can feature your comments in our future episodes. Okay, let's get started. When it comes to the world energy shortages, there is a lot at stake for every country. Let's face it, fuel, energy, it all starts from there when it comes to production and everything else, really. But are there politics at play here? Well, let's look at China. In line with transitioning to green energy and fulfilling green commitments, China announced in September 21 that it will stop building coal-burning power plants abroad. That marked a major shift for a country that is heavily reliant on coal. This entry reveals just that. China pledges to stop building coal-burning power plants abroad in a major shift for one of the biggest backers of coal-fired plants globally. Still, China remains heavily reliant on new coal plants at home and is the world's top emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. Well, that was on September 21. Then came October 13. In less than a month, a 360-degree turn, China announces a power problem and said that there is a national rush, that is, to mine and to burn more coal, as the country's electricity shortage threatens to damage its image as a reliable manufacturing base. Okay, so there you have it. Well, let's find out from our guest and see what he thinks. We turn to Joe Quinn. Joe, it seems like China and many like it cannot move away from coal.
In terms of China, China, there's talk in China of moving again away from, I mean, China produces about 50% of its energy supply from coal, and of course the greening of the economy, etc., in the face of climate change requires countries to move away from burning fossil fuels like coal, but there's simply no way that China is going to move away from, to any great extent, move away from the burning of coal and oil and gas.
Okay, well, Joe doesn't think that. Well, when we take a look at the reaction from a viewer out there, Fred Jacobs is the one that we picked, a 57-year-old software marketer who lives in Seattle, Washington, in the U.S., who wrote, ordered two high-performance solid-state drives in late summer from China, only to be offered a refund a week ago because of a lack of electricity, which would cause factory delays. Now, doesn't this sound exactly like what the U.S. is actually wishing for? Anything to hurt China's economy? It looks like this was a Christmas gift that came early for the White House. Well, Fred further added, I was flabbergasted because I have heard about shipping issues with China, but not power issues or infrastructure issues with Chinese suppliers. Now the risk is much higher, and I will buy from U.S. vendors, even if I have to pay more. Okay, let's turn to oil now. Prices of oil have skyrocketed. This tweet states that the global energy crisis sends crude oil prices to the highest levels since late 2018. Which is around $85 a barrel, based on this entry. This shows how the green push is being defeated. Now, there's a viewer by the name of Pisk, who has stated in his tweet, as more renewable energy enters the markets and it closes nuclear power, more gas and fuel needs to be burned, as the power generated from renewable is marginal. But there are many comments that go actually beyond mainstream news, like this one that came from DMAC. And he wrote, we're assuming that it's a he, that this so-called shortage was planned to manipulate our economy and increase the rate of inflation, that it's a continuation of the last time that Obama and Joe were in office. Just remember the prices the last time around and look at the current gas and power price to have increased. Okay, let's find out what Paolo thinks. Paolo Raffone, what can you say about the global shortage? Any government interference, or should I say manipulation, that's going on here?
Well, the energy crunch is something that could have been foreseen before the COVID, and of course the COVID has increased the possibility that this could happen. It did, in fact. That the entire system of the globalized supply of energy and goods, in fact, is very fragile. It's very fragile because it is extremely influenced by geopolitical confrontations and instability.
Okay, global agreements. Let's see if that's going to turn out to be the case. So geopolitical factors obviously impact the global energy crunch. By the way, the viewer comment that we mentioned before Paulo Rofone was speaking of, started speaking, which was about gas prices during the time Obama was president and his VP was Biden, to have hit peak prices. Do you think that was true? Well, let's do a flashback and a background check here. And here you have it. This is a snapshot to refresh your memory. The text added to the bottom of the photo reads, just a reminder of what things looked like the last time that Biden was in the White House. Okay, we would like it if you got engaged with us. You can write to us and tell us what you think about anything, especially about the program or topics that you want us to cover. Our links and addresses are here. We would love to hear from you. Now it's time to pass the torch to Macdi so he can tell you more about the world energy crunch and a realistic solution to the matter, as you're about to find out.
Thank you, Kevin. The energy crunch has taken the world by surprise, and it seems no country or continent will be immune to it. Take the oil prices. They've touched their highest in almost 7 years. As of the recording of this program, WTI crude oil was selling for a little over $82 per barrel. Natural gas prices were at record high as China was facing shortages coming on the back of global demand. Gas prices in the EU, which imports 90% of its gas, have skyrocketed almost 600% this year. Not that other commodities haven't. One main reason is that inventories at European storage facilities are at historically low levels for this time of year. The EU has blamed Russia for using gas as a political tool, something drawing anger from the Russian President Vladimir Putin. With consumers facing a huge jump in winter fuel bills, energy prices have topped the European Union's political agenda. The EU has presented what it has called a toolbox, short and medium-term measures to help people and businesses get through the winter. These measures include emergency income support to households, state aid for companies, and targeted tax reductions. In one respect, there has been a push to prevent climate change, and this means stopping the use of coal or even nuclear power plants.
It is a serious issue. I think we have to be very clear that the gas prices are skyrocketing, and but the renewables, the prices have decreased over the last years and are stable.
The situation for the UK is grim. If there are rising energy bills this winter, many more Brits can die of the cold in what is known as fuel poverty. Just last year, it was reported that on average, there are 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. An average of 9,700 deaths each year are believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
Every winter, millions of people struggle to heat their homes, and the rising cost of energy just increases the misery.
China, meanwhile, has also been hit by the low energy supplies as it tries to ensure there is enough energy supply across the country this winter and next spring. Many regions in China have seen tight supply of electricity since September. By some accounts, China is in a state of emergency when it comes to oil and gas. So much so that China has ordered state-owned energy companies to do whatever it takes to secure fuel supplies. But China has not sat idle. For example, a chemical company in northwest China's Shaanxi province has pledged to develop the country's energy industry through a green and low-carbon path. Energy shortages, astronomical gas prices, bottlenecks in supply chains. Is there a solution on the horizon? Not just a quick fix, which can address the problem? Sure there is. Iran oil minister has said that sanctions removal will help solve global energy crisis. He said the unprecedented surge in gas prices in Europe was driven by a fall in gas storage levels. All this is happening while Iran has been deprived of exporting its oil for many years. Europeans and Americans are now struggling with such an issue while their governments have long imposed illegal and cruel sanctions against our crude oil exports. Venezuela is another country sanctioned by the U.S. that can fill the worldwide energy shortage. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves. And it ranks 8th in the world when it comes to natural gas reserves. So, it looks like the stage is set for an all-out scramble among Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and South America for shipments of LNG from exporters. And this is where countries like Iran and Venezuela can be a good fit for providing the much-needed oil and gas. So, what do you think? Shouldn't the EU and US lift their illegal sanctions? Iran can help their energy needs and the world for that matter. Because this problem is not going away anytime soon. Please write to us and let us know what you think. These are our links and addresses. It's goodbye until next week.
In my final thoughts, I would like to focus first on the supply chain. The supply chain damage could have been a lot less, or even eliminated, were it not for the COVID-19 vaccine greed from the rich countries, like from the G7 countries, who are still hoarding the vaccine, by the way. Many of the links are developing countries, like in Africa maybe or elsewhere, that still need vaccines. Then comes another very important point. The massive energy supplies that can be added to the world supply, but is being prevented from doing so. Why? Because of the U.S. and its sanctions. And, of course, I'm talking about Iran and also Venezuela, who have massive supplies of oil and gas. Imagine if their products were to be poured into the supplies of the world in terms of energy. Well, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen because the U.S. would rather have its people suffer, have its citizens suffer from inflation, for example, and yet not have oil come from these two countries due to political objectives that it has. That is for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. It was great to have you. Until next week, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who oversaw the inquiry into sexual harassment claims against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that ultimately led to his resignation, declared her candidacy for Governor of New York on Friday, 29th of October, setting up a history-making, high-profile matchup in the Democratic primary. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Gluck. The piece is titled, Letitia James Declares Her Candidacy for New York Governor. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who oversaw the inquiry into sexual harassment claims against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that ultimately led to his resignation, declared her candidacy for Governor of New York on Friday, 29th of October, setting up a history-making, high-profile matchup in the Democratic primary. She begins the campaign as Governor Kathy Hochul's most formidable challenger, and her announcement triggers a start to what may be an extraordinary competitive primary, a contest set to be shaped by issues of ideology, race, and region in a state still battling its way out of the pandemic. Her announcement comes at a volatile moment in state politics, a day after former Governor Andrew Cuomo was charged in a sexual misconduct complaint based on the account of one woman whose claim of sexual harassment were detailed in the Attorney General's report. That development, Letitia James said, validated the findings in our report, and to her allies it further cemented the case for her leadership. But it has also added fresh fuel to Andrew Cuomo's suggestion that her investigation was politically motivated, a message that may resonate with some of the voters who still view Andrew Cuomo favorably. I'm running for Governor of New York because I have the experience, vision, and courage to take on the powerful on behalf of all New Yorkers, Letitia James wrote on Twitter as she released her announcement video on Friday. In the video, a narrator said that Ms. James was running for good-paying jobs, a healthcare system that puts people ahead of profits, to protect the environment, make housing more affordable, and lift up our schools in every neighborhood. The video did not mention Andrew Cuomo by name. Letitia James, a veteran Brooklyn politician and the first woman of color to be elected to statewide office in New York, is seeking to become the first black female governor in the country. Kathy Hochul, who is white, is the state's first female chief executive and the first governor in more than a century to have deep roots in western New York. The race may have even broader implications as a key barometer of the direction of the Democratic Party in the Biden era. Kathy Hochul of the Buffalo area was once known as a more conservative Democrat, but she has increasingly moved to the left. Letitia James, by turn, has plenty of connections to the relatively moderate Democratic establishment, but also has long-standing ties to the left-wing Working Families Party. It is not yet clear what issues she will use to differentiate herself politically from Kathy Hochul, but there is plainly the potential for vigorous clashes over how best to move the New York State and the Democratic Party forward. Her announcement came 2 days after the New York Times and other media outlets reported that she and her team had begun informing key political players of her intentions. Since she was first elected as a Working Families Party candidate nearly 20 years ago, Tish has been a courageous fighter for everyday New Yorkers, said Sochi Nameka, the state director of the New York Working Families Party. We expect that Tisch will campaign with a clear progressive vision for New York. And meanwhile, Letitia James herself has tweeted, "I'm running for governor of New York because I have the experience, vision, and courage to take on the powerful on behalf of all New Yorkers. Let's do this together." Ms. James enters the race with a record that has drawn acclaim from many liberals in the state. As Attorney General, she made headlines for suing the National Rifle Association, the NRA, investigating President Donald Trump, and presiding over the Andrew Cuomo inquiry, which was conducted by outside lawyers. "I've sued the Trump administration 76 times, but who's counting?" she deadpanned in the video. She appeared to make several allusions to Andrew Cuomo. "I've held accountable those who mistreat and harass women in the workplace, no matter how powerful the offenders," she said at one point in the video. "I've spent my career guided by a single principle, stand up to the powerful on behalf of the vulnerable," she said at another point in the video, "to be a force for change." Letitia James' allies believe that she could assemble a powerful coalition that includes black voters of varying ideological views, a broad swathe of left-leaning voters who welcomed her probes of Andrew Cuomo, national donor interested in her history-making potential, and a base in the most vote-rich part of the state. She has deep connections to some labor leaders. 2. John Samuelson, the international president of the Transport Workers Union, declared minutes after Letitia James' announcement that she will be a governor that working New Yorkers can trust. His union officially endorsed Letitia James a few hours later, the first union endorsement in the race for governor, a campaign noted. In recent weeks, Letitia James has moved to build out her political and fundraising teams, and she begins the contest with significant New York City connections after serving on the city council as a public advocate. She has also spent time traveling across New York in her official capacity and for purely political outings. And she and her team have sounded out donors, labor leaders, and elected officials as she moved towards the bid. Her team has begun seeking commitments for early endorsements that could help her build momentum quickly. But Kathy Hochul begins the race with her own significant advantages. She has been racing to cement an overwhelming fundraising edge. Receptive donors are one of the many benefits of incumbency. She is likely to perform strongly upstate, and she has spent years building relationships on Long Island. Since becoming governor, Kathy Hochul has maintained a breakneck public schedule heavily concentrated in the five boroughs, working to shore up her downstate strength and tapping a Lieutenant Governor, Brian Benjamin, who hails from Harlem, New York. And she has already locked down significant institutional support from groups including the Democratic Governors Association and Emily's List, the fundraising powerhouse that backs female candidates who support abortion rights. She has been endorsed by county chairs across the state, the state Democratic chairman, and the president of the NAACP New York State Conference.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, and, you know, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is, if any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand the criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Iran's capital, Tehran, hosted a meeting on its neighboring country, Afghanistan. The top diplomats of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have attended the gathering in person, while the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers were present online. The UN chief also sent a message to the summit online.
We need to keep engaging to help move things in the right direction. Force Afghans and the region also need a country that is secure, not one that is a haven for terrorism or a center for drug trafficking. This is vital to peace and stability in the region and around the world. Excellencies, these are all issues on which the region has a shared interest and on which all of us must speak with one voice. We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
The Wednesday conference took place a week after the third meeting of the Moscow Format Consultations on Afghanistan was held in the Russian capital.
The Tehran meeting is aimed at stepping up collaborations between Afghanistan's neighboring countries and creating lasting peace there. Iran has always strongly advised against the interference of foreigners in Afghanistan's affairs and respected the country's independence and territorial integrity. It has also urged the formation of an inclusive government in the country.
In Afghanistan, we are facing a situation that in order to reach an acceptable point for all Afghans, we still have a long way ahead of us.
Amir Abdullahian said this is a joint press conference with the visiting Pakistani counterpart Shah Mahmood Qureshi in Tehran. He added that Iran was pursuing contacts with all neighbors to Afghanistan to make sure the utmost use of capacities was achieved at its border crossings for trade and humanitarian aid delivery. The United States is a major factor in the current mess in Afghanistan. The U.S. military led the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 in what it proclaimed was a war on terror, meant to eradicate the Taliban. 20 years on, in mid-August this year, the Afghan government and military collapsed in the face of the Taliban's swift advances on the ground, which many attribute to a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led occupation forces from the country. The UN World Food Program says 3.2 million children under 5 are close to acute malnutrition. Afghanistan is now on the brink of bankruptcy. The U.S. has frozen $10 billion of the country's assets in a bid to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country. It's believed that the presence of Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan perfectly serves the interests of Americans.
Well, yeah, Islamic State has been used by the U.S., as has Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So they use these proxies to destroy the stability of countries.
Afghanistan lies at the crossroads of South and Central Asia. It has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, which killed scores of people, most of them were Shia worshippers. There are reports that in the months before the U.S.-led coalition forces left the country, thousands of terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, North Caucasus, Pakistan, and China's Xinjiang region. Most of them were recruited by Daesh.
Every indication is that the U.S. will try, which is why this inclusive government is needed to resist such abilities to drive a wedge in society.
These foreign terrorists slipped into the country under the nose of U.S. and NATO forces. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but further fanned its flames.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also referred to as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, target squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back to Saudi Arabia.
A psychopath with no empathy, doesn't feel emotion, never learned from his experience, and we have witnessed atrocities and crimes committed by this killer. And the warning I received, don't be in a proximity of any Saudi mission in Canada. Don't go to the consulate. Don't go to the embassy. Said why? Said they dismembered the guy. They kill him. You are on the top of the list.
Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
Well, I would say that Mohammed bin Salman, the supposed Saudi crown prince, never really goes to school and learns any kind of lesson whatsoever. He got away with murdering Khashoggi in Turkey, and the Americans huffed and puffed, and the intelligence services said that he was most likely involved, that the Saudis were definitely involved, and nothing was done about it.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confine of its borders. As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions of announcing the reforms in the first place. In the meantime, Al-Jabri alleged in the interview that MBS had even mentioned his intention of assassinating Saudi Arabia's former King Abdullah, and that there is video evidence proving it.
That's what he said, whether he's just bragging, or but he said that, and we took it seriously.
Does this video recording still exist?
Yes. I know where it is it's now. I know there are two copies of that. I know where they are.
Well, the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is desperately afraid of Saad al-Jabri. Al-Jabri was in the interior ministry. He was the interior minister's right-hand man. And he knows where the bodies are buried and where the money went. He has stated, to my knowledge, that the king and his son, Mohammed bin Salman, have been dipping into the Saudi government funds more than what is being appropriated for them, which astonishingly is $800 million per month.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. from the very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'll close the window or I'll get crazy by the noise of cars coming and going. Ooh, what a relief. Do you know what my biggest wish is? To live in a house in a remote village. To wake up with the roosters crowing. To be able to hear the sound of wind blowing through the fields. Or to hear the sound of dogs which bark at night. And then fall asleep with cricket's lullaby. Oh, it's just a dream. Anyway, yes, where we are going to visit today. An amazing eye-catching village. Varkhane village. Varkhane village is located in Hamedan province. This village is situated 25 kilometers to the city of Hamedan. Varkhane village is in a mountainous region on the southern foothills of Zagros Mountain. The first and oldest neighborhood in this village is Darbe Masjid. This neighborhood dates back to early Safavid era. The architecture of Varkhane village is unique, since all its buildings are made of stone. The ceiling of the houses are also made of wooden poles covered with adobe or tar paper. The houses of Varkhane are constructed toward the south so that they can enjoy the sunlight the most, especially during the cold winters of the village. I am in Varkhane village now. I'm so pleased that I'm away from the noise of the city and come here to this beautiful village. In front of me, there are houses which are completely made of stone. The sunshine on these houses makes a brown-colored reflection, which has made the scenery like a brilliant painting. I'm taking a walk in the cobbled alleys of Varkhane. On my two sides, there are beautiful stone-made houses as well as green gardens which I can't take my eyes off them. Varkane is one of the 6 touristic villages of Hamedan. This village is registered in Iran's National Heritage List. Now I've reached to the strange cemetery of Varkane village. You may ask yourself why I call this cemetery strange. Because there is no gravestone here. I've never seen such a cemetery in whole of my life. And here I am in the horse breeding stable of Varkane. There are beautiful horses here. Tourists can ride on them and have a tour around here and enjoy the scenery. Varkane village is very green and pleasant. And the sunlight makes extraordinary scenes by shining on the stone houses. I really can't take my eyes off all these beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests